Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy. The way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
Well, one of the most interesting people I've spoken to in a while, Chloe Valdery, is going to come on, and we'll talk all about race and relations and all that. So that's coming. First, I'll tell you about Meguiar's car waxes. They've come a long way. Last year, Meguiar's introduced hybrid ceramic spray wax. It's advanced SiO2 hybrid technology, delivers ceramic wax protection and durability. No rubbing, curing, or buffing. Provides extreme water beating action. That's how you know it's working. This year, Meguiar's launched their new liquid version. Seals the paint for long-lasting protection against the elements. Easy to use. Apply it like traditional liquid wax. Also, the hybrid ceramic spray detailer. This stuff works so good. You can save a lot of water. You know, half the time you don't even really need to wash your car. Just get it in a cool place, get in a little some shade and give it the spray detailer. And it's it removes contaminants like dust, fingerprints, bird droppings, boosts the gloss, enhances the protection. Ceramic made easy. It's Meguiar's.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all woke, no joke culture.
I love these as seen on TV products. I knew they were going to phase out the penny, but I didn't realize they'd already taken a ton out of circulation and infused all that copper into socks, underwear, t-shirts, and work gloves. The ads always have some aged NFL player saying, I can use my hands again, thanks to copper fit gloves. Or my knees don't ache, thanks to my copper infused leggings. Or my wife had 5 orgasms last night, thanks to my copper fit condom.
Available now in all formats. Pick up a copy now at adamcarolla.com.
Chloe Valdery is our guest today. Where are you joining us from, Chloe?
The Great Brooklyn.
The Great Brooklyn. Website, theoryofenchantment.com is where you can go. I was just watching your video on PragerU. I've made a few videos for PragerU, and I'm friends with Dennis Prager, so always appreciate a Prager alumni.
Sure.
We'll talk. Well, let's. How would you? What is your title? What should we call you? Or how would you like to be called?
You can refer to me as the founder of Theory of Enchantment.
And what are some of the principles of Theory of Enchantment?
So there are 3 principles. Number 1, treat people like human beings, not like political abstractions. Number 2, criticize to uplift and empower, never to tear down, never to destroy. And number 3, root everything you do in love and compassion.
So you're 27, you're a black woman, and tell us about how you grew up and how you sort of got to where you are today, or how you arrived on many of these thoughts and opinions. And was that something that was always in you, or did you sort of have a transformation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to try to sum up my journey so I don't take too much time in describing it. So I'm from New Orleans originally, and I grew up in a very atypical Christian family. Atypical in the sense that instead of going to church on Sunday, as is traditional, I ended up going to church on Saturday. I didn't grow up observing the traditional Christian holidays like Christmas and Easter. I grew up observing Jewish holidays like Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot. And I did all these things as a Christian, which meant that I was thrust into a paradoxical experience. I always have experienced this interesting phenomenon of existing within and outside of cultures. And so I'm aware of the paradox of life and the paradox of of that sort of experience as a result. And I'm easily able to see how things can connect to each other, and more prone to recognize patterns in two seemingly different modes of thinking, for example, as a result of that upbringing. I graduated from the University of New Orleans with a concentration in diplomacy. My background is in international studies. So I did a lot in college having to do with conflict resolution. I had an Israel club on campus. And as you can imagine, being involved in this space, I oftentimes encountered hostility and shouting matches on college campuses. And I always wondered, you know, is there a way to create a framework where you can use a framework to have difficult conversations, challenging conversations, but ultimately with the goal to get people to love each other, and ultimately with the goal of getting people to respect each other along the way. So after I graduated from college, I moved to New York. So this was 5 years ago, got a job at the Wall Street Journal. I was at the Wall Street Journal for a year as a Bartley Fellow, worked on a thesis paper that ended up being the catalyst for Theory of Enchantment. And again, I was focused on this question, can I actually teach people how to love one another in spite of the disagreements that they have? And so in that thesis paper, I asked myself, you know, well, if I want to figure out how to get people to love each other, maybe I have to ask, what are people already in love with? And then use that as a conduit to get them to love each other. And the biggest source of content that showed me what people were in love with was pop culture. So at that point in the research, I started studying all these pop culture corporations and influencers. I started studying Nike. I started studying Disney, started studying Beyonce to see if there was a common denominator across these individuals and companies in terms of their branding. And the common denominator was that they created content where their audience saw themselves and their potential reflected in the content. And that was it. And that's why we gravitated toward them as a consumer base. And, you know, this is obviously represented in companies like Nike that attaches the slogan, just do it, to their brand, right? So the idea is that if you buy their apparel, you'll be able to overcome any obstacle you encounter. Similarly to Disney, Disney's brand is very simple. You take a tragic or a imperfect hero, you put them in a situation where they have to overcome an obstacle, and they are turned or they are transformed into a hero by confronting that obstacle and overcoming it. And similarly to Beyonce, Beyonce says, who run the world, girls? Many women see themselves and their potential reflected in that content. So I thought, this is interesting that there's this common pattern across these different things we find in our pop culture. What am I going to call this phenomenon? I decided to call it enchantment because I was reading at the time a book by Guy Kawasaki, the former marketing director of Apple, who called enchantment. And he described the process of enchantment as the process by which you delight someone with an idea, personality, or a concept. And I thought, well, I think this is very enchanting, and this is the process by which we fall in love with each other, romantically and otherwise. So why not call it enchantment? So I called it the theory of enchantment. After being at the Wall Street Journal, I worked for a nonprofit for 2 years, lectured on this theory and the principles that I mentioned earlier. And increasingly, people responded to me by saying, you know, this is not just relevant when it comes to international studies and conflict resolution in a geopolitical sense. It's relevant in classrooms. It's relevant in schools. It's relevant in professional development trainings. You should consider expanding upon this. So enough people told me that, and I decided to go out on my own, start my own company, create an entire course around this concept. And now we have the theory of enchantment today.
Well, I'm at a little loss for words, and I never am, but, you know, I see what's going on with race relations. I see how the direction this country is going. I'm worried. And part of the thing that worries me the most is the process of taking a group and sort of explaining to them that they have a target on their back, that they're not welcome, that the country at large doesn't really want you in it and will act accordingly. And I keep thinking how insanely destructive that would be for any group you did it to. And when I hear these stories, and I hear the stories about Charlize Theron or Sandra Bullock, and they've adopted young black kids, and they have to sit down and explain to them what kind of society they live in and how they have a target on their back and how I think Charlize Theron said, I won't even take them to certain cities because I fear for their for their health, their safety. She never says the name of the city, by the way, but she always says that. And I thought, these kids are seven. You're poisoning them. I couldn't imagine telling kids you have a target on your back and expecting it to work out for them. My daughter, I'll be fast because people listening have heard this story before, but if you just kind of want to know where I'm at, when my daughter was, I don't know, 11 and a half, she tried out for the volleyball team. She didn't make the volleyball team. She came home. She told me she didn't make it because the coach hated her. And I talked to her for the longest time I've ever spoken to her in one sitting, making sure that she was convinced that it had to do with her ability to play volleyball and not because the coach, who didn't know her, magically hated her. I didn't want her walking around. She's now 14 and excelling at volleyball, but I felt like she was this close to quitting because she thought the power lied outside of her own ability or work ethic or ability to get, or maybe you weren't very good. Now let's work harder and get it. We'll have another tryout year from now. We're going to kick ass. The notion that as a society, we are doing this to a group of people ad nauseum, especially CNN and NBC and MSNBC, just beating them over the head that there's a target on your back. And all the politicians have dove in on this. Well, seems to be insanely destructive to me. And that's something I'm concerned about.
So listen, I think I come in part from had to study developmental psychology and developing the course that I teach. And I do believe that it is very important to teach folks about their own autonomy and their own agency, and that the locus of control should be internal. Now, the purpose of this is not to excuse egregious behavior. It's not to, you know, sort of be dismissive when things erupt out of society that are unjust and that do need to be rectified. But the purpose of this is to teach, especially young people, that ultimately it is important that they understand that they have a sense of self-worth internally that no one can take away from them, not outside society, not, you know, even their parents or other relatives, that ultimately that they are resilient enough and strong enough and independent enough to have, again, that sense of self-worth so that when they encounter hardship, when they encounter struggle, they will be equipped with the necessary emotional tools. And Theory of Enchantment is very much considered a social emotional learning program, with the emotional tools to withstand that. So I definitely agree with you that from a psychological perspective, it is very unhealthy to constantly tell an individual or a group of people over and over and over again that no one cares about them, because perception is reality. Once someone internalizes the idea that no one cares about them, one becomes susceptible to all kinds of, we'll say, forms of magical thinking, including conspiracy theory-oriented thinking. One becomes susceptible to the notion that the quote-unquote entire world is against them. And then one is susceptible to beginning to act in such a way that the world does actually end up becoming against you. Because if you believe that the world is against you and then you start acting hostile in a defensive way, then you will actually contribute to and engender that sort of response from people.
Yeah.
Again, though, this is sort of the individual analysis. It's not to be dismissive of problems in society, but to equip the individual to be able to overcome and withstand the suffering that one encounters within society.
Yeah. It becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. If you convince enough young black men that the cops are out to kill them, then when the cop pulls you over, you better wrestle his gun away because he's out to kill you. And then you create this thing, this self-fulfilling prophecy. So, I always say to everyone, of course there's bad cops and of course there's racism and of course there's bad volleyball coaches. Like I'm never going to deny the existence of a lot of this stuff. What I'm saying is you focus on being as good as you can be, whether it's, volleyball or business or citizen or husband or wife or whatever. Who really are screwed in our society? Short men. Short men, you're screwed. If you're born, there's like, I don't know, some stupid study out of the Fortune 500 companies. Two of them have a CEO that's under 6 foot. You know what I mean? Like, they just don't, you don't get to run Nabisco if you're a short dude. Like, that's just kind of how it works. But so you have a little disadvantage, and that's how you're born, and there's nothing we can do about it. Now, what are you going to do about it? That's kind of my, that's my approach. I think that everybody could make that claim about their life in one way, shape, or form. Their skin color, their height. How about just genetics, man? How about just strong genetics versus bad genetics, you know? Mm-hmm. Or how about someone has a disability? If you had a child with a disability, you would never try to convince that child that they couldn't live a good and normal life and prosper. Sure. Everyone with a disability, and anyone I know who's done well with a disability, said they had parents that said, I'm not going to treat you differently. You need to, you need to go. There's nothing wrong with you just because you're in a wheelchair, and it doesn't mean you can't do X, Y, and Z. If you said to that kid, you'll never get along, you'll always be in that wheelchair, society's always going to look down on you, that kid wouldn't stand a chance.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. I would say, in addition, that I think, insofar as the philosophy that I come to the table with, and insofar as theory of enchantment is concerned, I do believe that as many people as possible need to be sort of, maybe trained isn't the right word, but to be taught to internalize these ideas about themselves. Because obviously, if you find yourself in a situation where you are dealing with an irate cop or a cop who's prejudicial for whatever reason, that person obviously has more power in that particular context. He has a gun, right? He has the ability to kill you, literally. And so while we should be teaching our young Black men to have a sense of internal self-worth, we should also ensure that our cops are trained in such a way that they also understand themselves and their place in society and their role of protecting and serving the neighborhoods that they police, and that they also understand their internal sense of self-worth, because this goes both ways. I truly believe that when people are fundamentally insecure, it manifests in a whole host of negative ways. And we can see this in the context of policing. One can imagine, and I believe in sort of a holistic approach to police reform and restorative justice and some of the things we've been speaking about in our nation. So we talk about, for example, ending, qualified immunity and this sort of thing that was passed in the Supreme Court in the 60s that said you can't really sue a cop for wrongdoing if there's no precedent, right? So that's obviously something that needs to change in the law. But what also needs to change in the law is an understanding that cops need to have access to PTSD training and PTSD counseling, because obviously if you're a cop and a police officer, you see very violent things when you're out on the beat, and that can affect your psyche. And if you don't have the proper healing in place that's systematically put in place to help you deal with that, then you can end up projecting the negative effects of that onto the other people that you police, and then it compounds the situation, and then it becomes, again, another self-fulfilling prophecy. So a lot of the things that we're talking about really need to be implemented far and wide in the society, not only on an individual level. And obviously, you know, when we're talking about parents raising their kids, like you're talking about your daughter, you need to instill this in your children. But we also have to ask how we're going to sort of engender this kind of philosophy on a societal level so that less of these instances of police brutality occur in the long run.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a two-way street. Everybody, you know, there's certainly room for improvement on either side of the badge. I, as a former poor person, I have a unique perspective because I'm not Black or Hispanic, but I was poor for a long period of time. And I can tell you there's a different relationship with cops when you're poor versus driving nice neighborhoods, nice cars, and nice stuff. Yeah. Like people think, oh, it's kind of a black and white thing, but it's a lot of it is a socioeconomic thing. Like the poor people have a hard time with cops, or a harder time with cops.
Can you speak a little bit about your experience with that vis-a-vis poverty and socioeconomic status?
All right.
How it contributes to police brutality.
Cut me off when I get to minute 27. Okay. Well, first things first. You take something pretty simple, like you live in an apartment building and you don't have parking, so you park on the street. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you're just physically out on the street. Your cars are getting ticketed or towed. I've had a lot of stuff like towed. Then you have to go in and figure out how to get the thing out of compound, out of the tow mm-hmm. compound. The person behind the counter is never sympathetic as to how much money you have or if you have enough or, you know, just there's little things that sort of prey on poor people. Like if you, I'll go with parking for now. You're a poor person. You don't have a garage. You don't have a driveway. You don't have a home. You have an apartment. You have a street. You park the thing on the street. You didn't get, I've had this happen before, but maybe you don't have enough money and your car's not registered up to date. So the tabs are out of date. So now it gets towed. It goes to the tow yard on a Thursday night. You go in Friday morning at 8 a.m. The guy says, I got to charge you for two nights. You go two nights. Okay. It's been there for 9 hours. It came in 11 o'clock last night. It's 8 a.m. Yeah. Came in Thursday. Now I got to get it on Friday. Then you go, okay, how much? And it's, you know, $400 that you don't have. Mm-hmm. And the guy's not, you can argue with the guy all you want. He's got your car. You, by the way, need your car to get to work because you can't afford to take a day off. And it just kind of snowballs from there. Mm-hmm. Like, so also, you get pulled over a lot more because cops, I'll give you an example. I'm a rich guy. I drive a new car. My car has Tennessee plates on it, like temporary Tennessee plates on it from the dealer, from the manufacturer, whatever it is. I never get pulled over. The, mm-hmm. Because there's more paperwork to do. He's looking at a temporary plate when he's behind me. Right. He's not. I would drive around. Here's an interesting little study. I used to get pulled over a fair bit because I was a spirited driver. I started like that euphemism. I started leaving the cardboard dealer plate on the car. So it just said Galpin Ford and cardboard. I never got pulled over. Because it's like, that guy's got to go through extra work now. He can't just go write my license plate down or run my license plate. He's got to do more work. And I'm going to be insured. I'm not going to have a suspended driver's license. I'm probably not going to have warrants. I used to have warrants. I've been pulled over on a motorcycle and taken to jail because I had warrants. When you're a cop, and you pull someone over, you're kind of opening oysters and looking for pearls. And if you're pulling over a poor person, there's going to be some pearls. That person could have warrants, could have expired license, expired tabs, no proof of insurance. I mean, we're just going to keep writing summonses, right? You pull over a rich guy in new car, regardless of skin color, he's probably going to have his insurance. Everything's going to be up to date. He didn't steal the car. He doesn't have drugs on him. He doesn't have weapons on him. It's like, you just pull that guy over. You didn't really get much out of your time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I do believe cops are like, if I'm going to take the time to pull that guy over, I want to find some stuff. I want there to be a little payday. So when I was poor and I didn't have proof of insurance and I did have warrants and I didn't have X, Y, and Z, then that was a nice little payday for the cops. You know, when I got pulled over for my warrants, I got in the cop car. He drove me to the jail. I sat there, cost, you know, $650 to get me out. Like they got paid. They pulled me over now. They're not going to get paid.
I see.
You see, so I think there's a real direct element of that. I think it's the same sometimes with like stop and frisk. Like I'm going to pull that 17-year-old black guy over. I might find something on him. That red-haired chick who's 45, I'm not going to bother with her. I'm probably I don't have as high percentage of batting average with her as I do with him, which is obviously then turns into a problem. But if you want to know kind of the genesis of it, I think cops are going, I'm in the business of finding stuff. And I got a higher batting average of pulling the poor guy over than I do pulling the rich guy over.
Well, I think this is all like, this all speaks to issues that are like systemically problematic, right? Because if you think about, you know, if the way the structure is set up, if a cop is being underpaid and receives more of a salary or more income based upon making a quota, right, then a cop has a greater incentive to try to find and scope out individuals and essentially bother people more because that's directly tied to their income and to their paycheck. So that's an issue, number one. Number two, another issue is, of course, the intersection of race and class. We saw the senator out of, I think, Virginia, senator, could be getting that wrong, but Tim Scott, I believe, talked about how, you know, he is a African-American man who's wealthy, was pulled over in a rich neighborhood precisely because of his skin color, because the cops simply did not expect that he, as a Black man, would own a wonderful car and be living in such a neighborhood. And so that's also an issue. And we can talk about the intersection of how that happens more often. But there's also a great book that speaks about this issue of poverty and how it plays a role in a lot of these situations. The name of the book is called The Best of Enemies. And it was actually turned into a movie, but it's based on a true story by Osher Gray Davidson. And it's a story about how basically the rich people in the neighborhood, both Black and white, had an incentive to whip into a frenzy the poor Blacks and the poor whites against each other so that there was less attention being paid to the classism that was informing and affecting the society. And so I highly recommend that book. I encourage your listeners to read it because it's interesting because it talks about the intersection of class and race. And one guy, one of the main characters in the guy, who was a poor white person who felt the need to actually join the Ku Klux Klan because he was a poor white person, has this sort of come to Jesus moment at the end of the book where he realizes the game that was being run and you know, sort of renounces his views and has a real emotional moment where he realizes, you know, this poor Black woman on the other side of the train track, so to speak, is also fighting for the same thing he's fighting for. And he's been distracted and basically, you know, wasting time on racial petty differences when really he should have been joining forces with her and trying to get better services, better social services that wasn't being extended to people simply because of their income levels. And so, yeah, I think we have to ask better questions, more questions about that issue. And not forget to neglect that issue in our society today.
Yeah, the other insight you have, if you're a white guy like me, so I'm white, I'm heterosexual, and you know, I don't have any reason society should put a target on my back. But I also have sort of insights that you could probably only have if you're straight and white and living in a society where the straight white people sort of have, you know, they got the wind blowing at their back. Mm-hmm. I have had so many negative experiences with neighbors in many houses all over the Los Angeles that I've lived in, and acutely unreasonable negative neighbors that did things that were like sort of way beyond the pale. It wasn't like, well, my tree is growing into their yard, could I come over and trim it? I'm talking about calling Department of Building and Safety on me and saying that my house had unsanitary living conditions. I've seen it all. I won't bore you with the details. I will tell you this. If I was a Black family instead of a white family, I would for sure think the old white guy that was calling Department of Building and Safety on me was a racist. I'm white, so no. I'm just confused. He's a fucking idiot. I'm glad he's dead. But the point is if we were the Huxtables living in my house and this old white coot was calling a Department of Building Safety and complaining and screaming at my wife and stuff like that, I'd go, well, of course this guy's a racist. There's no other conclusion to draw. So if you're Black, you don't get that perspective. You would arrive at that. I've had this with almost every neighbor I've had. And I had a house once in Sherman Oaks, California. I was doing a little work on it, and I picked up the phone, doing a little remod. I picked up the phone to call a lumber store. When I heard a voice on the other end, I realized our phone lines had got crossed, that I was talking to a neighbor because of the construction, okay. Something landline before you were born. Like, I picked up this thing. I was like, hello, Terry Lumber. And they were like, hello, who is this? This is Agnes. You know, who? I thought I was calling. And she's like, no, you're. I said, oh, sorry, something's wrong with the phone line. I hung the phone up. 20 minutes later, police car showed up. She called the cops.
Why?
Well, that's okay, because she's a bitch. That's my point. But if I'm black, I'm like, oh, yeah. She called the cops because I'm black.
Right, right,
and I'm
right,
saying,
right. I see what you're saying.
There yeah. is a lot of that. There is a lot of it out there that you can't. I would
it's
not.
It's hard to discern. It's difficult to discern.
It's hard to discern. Yeah. Well, no, it's impossible to discern, really. Yeah. But if I were black, I would look at that as a incident that would be racially based in my in my mind. It had nothing to do with race, but how could I interpret it any other way?
Right. Well, you could just assume. Yeah, you could, you know, as per your words just a few minutes ago, you could assume. Just, you know, someone being a jackass.
Right.
But it is difficult because this is how I look at it. It's like from a psychology perspective, in terms of even if you are experiencing these kinds of things and they are racially motivated, I interviewed Daryl Davis. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but Daryl Davis, in addition to being an amazing musician, rock and roll and other forms of amazing music, and he's also played with some of the greats, actually, including some of the folks that were originally with Elvis. I think he might have played with Elvis, but I may be making that up. But anyway, in addition to that, his other claim to fame is being an African-American man who convinces members of the KKK to leave the KKK.
Oh, that guy. Yes. Now I know who that is.
And to give up their robe. They end up giving up their robes when they do.
Right.
And so I've seen these robes. I interviewed him for my podcast and I asked him, you know, don't you get insulted or offended when you're first meeting these guys and they start saying really bad things about black people? And he says, no, I don't, because that has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. He said, I know who I am and I know, you know, what I stand for, and my internal sense of worth is strong and steady, and I'm a resilient person. And so I understand that what they're saying about me has absolutely nothing to do with me. It has to do with them. And he's able to depersonalize it in that way. So the advice that I would give to people, even as they rightfully so seek out justice and, you know, redress to wrong when they are unjustly treated, that's sort of a legal right. That's a legal dynamic that we're discussing, but from a psychology perspective, and a psychological dynamic, it's important to tell people who are unfairly, you know, accosted, if you will, to remember not to personalize it, to remember not to internalize these things that other folks, for whatever reason, their insecurities, their pettiness, their lack of strong character are projecting onto you. It's important not to internalize that. It's important to depersonalize it for the sake of your own soul, right?
Yes.
To keep yourself intact.
Yeah, it's funny. I always looked at them as crazy or pain in the ass or whatever. I never looked at it as something to do with me. Mm-hmm. I'm just the person that made the mistake of buying the house next to them. I'm sure anyone else, they'd do the exact same thing to.
Much more with Adam Carolla and Chloe Valdery right after this.
Just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut.
Hey, Corolla fans, Mike Dawson here. I got some good news and some bad news. Bad news first, we're sold out of this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Good news is you'll still be able to get all the incredible products from beerbong.com and Beard Bro after this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Head to beerbong.com and get your 6-foot beer bong and a gold mine of other beer-related products. Believe us, you will get drunk. And social distance if you need to. For all of you bearded men out there, remember to head to thebeardbro.com for all your facial hair needs. A big thank you to both Beardbro and beerbong.com for participating in this month's nut. We'll see you soon for another shipment of Adam's Monthly Nut.
So how do we right the ship, if that in fact applies here? Like, what should our plan be as a nation, or micro and macro? Like, what are some ideas that, if you had a magic wand and you could implement some ideas, what would you like to do moving forward?
Well, I want everyone to take the Theory of Enchantment course. So let's just say that everyone should take the Theory of Enchantment course. It's a fun course because it uses pop culture to teach these ideas of character development and resiliency and overcoming suffering. So it's a great course that everyone should take. But in addition to that, if I had a magic wand, I'd say, I think that there needs to be an aspect of civil service. That's a part of like what it means to be an American. So if that means like incentivizing a spirit of and a culture of volunteerism in the country, I think that that should be somehow implemented. I know that some high schools have it where you can't graduate unless you have X amount of hours of volunteering. I think that if you could like scale that and make that happen on a national level somehow, not mandatory, because mandatory volunteering is sort of an oxymoron, but incentivizing it in some way, I think would be good, because that would force us to actually meet each other across ethnic, socioeconomic, gender-based, etc. Boundaries. It would force us to be engaged in acts of service. I think it would make us a much more compassionate people and a much more compassionate nation. And it would also make us realize that some of the petty disputes that we get caught up in politically are just that, are petty, and they're more important things in life than a lot of the political disputes that we get in. And it would also foster a kind of neighborliness that I think is missing, in part because we are, especially, you know, now post COVID, we're always on our phones. We're becoming atomized and very like, in a way, an unhealthy way, very hyper-rational and very mechanized in our human relationships. And this is exacerbated, of course, by COVID. We don't really connect to each other in a face-to-face way. So I think that if we could somehow incentivize volunteering on a national level, which is a huge project in and of itself, that would take an entire team to do and a lot of heads being put together. So that's what that would be my contribution to how we heal this nation.
It's a very strong idea, and I'm glad. Because I always say, when people just go, oh, we got to defund the police or whatever the version of that is, it's like, that's not really fixing something. That's just taking people off the street. Where do you come down on vouchers, school choice, education in general?
Oh, my goodness. This is such a big question. How do I answer this question in like 2 minutes?
You got more than that.
Look, I am a product of multiple different forms of schooling. I've been to public schools. I've attended charter schools. I tend to believe that states should offer both kinds of schooling, both public and charter schools. I don't know much about the voucher school system, as I haven't experienced that personally, or the voucher.
Let's just say school choice.
But yeah, school choice in general is something that I've certainly benefited from. So I would say, to the extent that I have, I would want that to be an option for students, especially for students from impoverished areas. I will say, I read a textbook on the history of education in America a few months ago, and there is some study that school choice works better in, that shows that school choice works better in cities as opposed to rural towns. I'm not quite sure why that is, but there is something to that that's worth looking at and worth delving into. So apart from that caveat, I'd say by and large, I've been a beneficiary of school choice. And so to the extent that it is successful, I would like to see others have access to that.
What, tell us your relationship with school choice or your experience.
So I attended Benjamin Franklin Charter High School in New Orleans, Louisiana. Shout out to the Franklin Falcons.
Sorry, that starts in the ninth grade there, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it does. Okay. It is the number one public school. It's the number one high school in all of Louisiana. So I'm very proud of being a graduate of that school. And I had, you know, I received a world-class education. I attended schooling with people of all different backgrounds from not only, you know, different ethnic backgrounds, but different countries, quite frankly.
It's number one academically.
Yes, it's number one academically.
Sorry.
Sorry for good clarification. It's number one academically in the state of Louisiana. the education that I received was, you know, foundational to my standing here today and the way I see the world. And I think that everyone should be able to have access to that kind of a world-class education, and also should be able to be exposed to meeting people of different backgrounds and different, you know, cultural and otherwise, in the same way that I was.
So I know in Louisiana, traditionally, the public schools aren't strong. And so I'm guessing the schools around that school weren't great.
Go ahead.
And you made it into that school how?
Well, it's interesting because New Orleans actually has a mixed bag in terms of its educational history. So a lot of the schools there that were public, that are public, were actually very well performing prior to Hurricane Katrina. And then when Hurricane Katrina hit, everything sort of went down. So that's number one. Number two, have to remember that New Orleans has a very heavily French influence and French Roman Catholic influence. So a lot of the schools are private schools in New Orleans. Most of the people that I knew of all backgrounds, you know, white, African American, et cetera, many of them went to these private schools, just because that's just the culture of New Orleans, of these private Catholic schools. My mom went to a private Catholic school as well. So there's also that component that doesn't necessarily exist to the same extent in other cities. And then you had the poor performing public schools. So it wasn't this binary of like really great schools and really poor schools. How did I get into Franklin? I mean, you have to take a test to get in. So it's like a standardized test. I really don't remember the details because it's such a long time ago, but you know, I mean, I just took a test and got in. So that's the simple answer to your question.
Was there a waiting? Was there a lottery? Were more people trying to get in than they would accept?
There was no lottery. I think also that Franklin has been a charter school for a long time. I'm not sure how it affects like the whole lottery system question. I don't think it is affected by the lottery system. I think that Franklin is a school, and I'll look into this afterwards because these are very good questions that I should know the answers to. But I think ultimately Franklin is a school where it's like either you take the test and you get in, or you fail the test and you don't get in. I think it's as simple as that. But it is a charter school.
Yeah, I'm the more I look into charter schools and all that, the more I like it because I just like the competition, and I don't like the luck of the draw where you're in a bad neighborhood, you get a bad school, and now your hand has been dealt to you and you have to play it. I don't like that. I'm worried. It bothers me that so many politicians are against school choice. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't like that it's been politicized.
I have a question for you on that, because I keep hearing this, but I'm like, is it actually true that most politicians are against it, or is it some politicians are against it and then like the media replays this to us?
I think Democrats by and large are against it because of this teachers union and being sort of mobbed up with the teachers union. So Democrats work with the teachers union, get votes from the teachers union, get money from the teachers union. So the charter schools don't have unions. So the teachers and the unions don't want charter. Look, they don't want competition. I wish there were no other podcasts on iTunes, right? And then I get rid of every podcast, and then I could just show up drunk and mail it in every day and be number one perennially every single year. So, I mean, sure. I get it. I bet every pizza joint wishes there wasn't another pizza joint down the street, but that's kind of how we work. So sure. The teachers don't want the competition, and the teachers unions don't want the non-union teachers, and the teachers kind of dictate which way the politicians go. So the teachers say no, and then so the Democrats speak out against school choice and charter schools, and they make a lot of sort of allegations about taking money out of the public schools and a lot of pretty disingenuous, spurious stuff that really isn't true, but they have to make the case because what they're doing is they're doing something that's immoral. They really are. They're hurting the people they claim to want to protect. The Democrats want to protect the young black and brown kids, and they're hurting the young black and brown kids. So they have to make a kind of argument that ends up being a sort of moral argument, but it's not. It's a financial thing with the teachers union. Now, the Republicans don't care that much. Like most folks that are Republican are for school choice and generally for competition in general. Mm-hmm. They sort of just believe, good, let them compete. Let the best man win. I believe that if you had a little competition in schooling, it would raise the game of the public school as well. They would have to get better mm-hmm. at what they did. But I think a lot of the Republicans are sort of somewhere between, who cares? And I'm not going to die on that hill. And maybe I don't want to be called a racist for whatever reason, however this thing gets bent up and twisted around or something like that. So they don't really care that much. And thus, it's not an issue. And then the media sort of sides with the Democrats. So you have Democrats, teachers, and media sort of against school choice for no good reason. And then the Republicans are like, we're going to focus on lowering taxes and beefing up the border. You know what I mean? Like no one on our side really cares about the poor kids and the school choice anyway.
So, well, listen, I hear you. I think there's a lot of blame on many sides. I personally, when it comes to politics, when people ask me what my political orientation is, I say I'm an artist, and I mean that sincerely. And I hate to complicate the sort of paradigm that you have just painted, but I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. Like Benjamin Franklin High School is a charter school that also has a union, for example. So again, it's not, in my experience, it's not this black and white dichotomy. I know, for example, when George Bush, Jr. was in office, many Democrats and Republicans worked together. This is sort of in a pre-polarized era of our politics. Many Democrats and Republicans historically have worked together when it comes to advancing the cause of school choice and just delving into and looking into the charter school system. So again, I don't think it's this. I don't think it's this sharp dichotomy between Democrats and Republicans. You certainly today have many Democrats sort of like looking down on school choice and painting it and portraying it in the way that you've described, but that's also not all Democrats, obviously. And a lot of the teachers in charter schools that I know are Democrats. So I just want to add that because I think we need in all of our conversations to be able to understand these complex issues for the nuance that they actually contain, because it's easy to sort of paint this black and white photo, but I do think it's far more complicated than that. And also the history of the public school system is in America is so complicated. We're talking about, our school system comes from an outdated Prussian model of schooling. So there's a lot of blame to go around in terms of the problems, the systemic problems in our schooling, Democrat and Republican alike. And I think that we need to work across the aisle, put pen to paper, and just try to develop policies and programming that will fulfill the needs of the kids. That's ultimately should be the end goal. Of course, things get complicated. You throw, financial issues into it. Money incentivizes things, and that's really unfortunate. But again, my overall point is that I think that there's a lot to blame, a lot of different kinds of politicians, historically speaking, to blame for the incompetence of our public school system. And I think that once we get over the sort of which football team are you on kind of approach, we can hopefully put pen to paper and really just like advance good, decent, sound educational reform.
Well, I can't argue with that. And I'm speaking from a California native sort of standpoint. So yeah. I have no idea what's going on in Louisiana. You have to be careful because you go, well, not all this and not all that. I will say in general terms, I live in California. We're very Democratic here. And sure. The charter school thing is not something we're fighting for here by and large. And I think we should be, and we're not. And it doesn't cross, you know, there's people on both sides who like both. But in general, that's the way it kind of falls out. And then there are things that in general fall on the shoulders of Republicans, you know, mm-hmm. and then there's going to be that, but it's never 100% for sure. So the notion, the theory of enchantment.com, mm-hmm. by the way, so I'll throw that out there. What,
thank you.
What would be some very basic things people could do? Or if I go to theoryofenchantment.com, what will greet me?
Well, so if you visit our website, you'll see the course. You'll see like what's in the course specifically. You'll see our approach to social emotional learning and why we believe both developmental psychology and pop culture are useful pedagogical tools to teach people, again, character development in a basic sense. If you are a teacher, you can, well, actually, you don't have to be a teacher, but it's geared toward teachers. Specifically, there's a free resource on the theory of enchantment that you can sign up for. And the free resource essentially teaches you how to use Disney in the classroom to teach different character building and relationship building tactics. So for example, one of the things that I teach in the course is how in almost every single Disney movie, in the first 5 minutes of the film, they tell you what the moral of the story is going to be. Mm-hmm. So take a film like Beauty and the Beast. Beauty and the Beast is a very, actually very deep film. And the moral of the story is who can ever learn to love a beast, right? I spoke about this recently in my USA Today article. And the sort of principle behind this question is to not judge people, number one, according to appearances, right? Don't judge people based on what's outside, but do so based upon what's inside, number one. And number two, be aware of the fact that people can change. So just as people can go from being, from engaging in good behavior to engaging in evil behavior, the opposite is also true, right? It's very possible for someone in the Beast's case to have been afflicted by vanity and shallowness and really just a sort of juvenile and superficial outlook on life, to becoming much more compassionate toward others, much more thoughtful about others. And if you don't believe that people are capable of engaging or in encountering this sort of transformation, you won't act in a manner that suggests that those people are actually capable of that. And this is the problem that I've brought up with sort of like, we're talking about police reform. This is why caricaturing and stereotyping cops is a really bad idea, right? Because if you think that a cop is evil or negligent in his behavior, and you say to that person, not only are you engaging in bad behavior, not only are you a monster or a beast, so to speak, but you will always be a beast. You can never change, because as long as you wear this uniform, as long as you represent this uniform, you will never be able to change. And so I condemn you because you're a beast, right? The moral of the story of Beauty and the Beast is not to do that. It's to stop doing that, because that is bad. And that is immoral and that is unethical. And of course, in the character of Belle, who represents wisdom, Belle is someone who understands that you have to be able to see the human being behind sort of static uniform, or in this case, the beastly outward appearance that the Beast had.
I've always thought, I mean, I've always mentioned this, that the animated stuff that Disney and Pixar and all those people are putting out from a story standpoint is so much stronger than just about any live action stuff that's filmed. I mean, when you...
Yes, I would agree with that.
You take a look at Finding Nemo or movies like that, and you're like, wow, it's such a strong story. Like, in a weird way, you know, live action stuff... From a perspective as a guy who's written a few scripts, I realize that the Pixar stuff and the Disney stuff is so much stronger in the writing. And maybe you need that because you don't have this beautiful leading woman in the flesh, or you don't have this hunky leading man in the flesh. Like, maybe you have to be that much better. It's not, or maybe it's that kids have a way of understanding story at a slightly more visceral level, than adults do. Like if you're gonna keep the attention of a 5 or 7 year old, you really have to have story. Can't just be good looking people walking around. You know?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I also, you know, a lot of their live action stuff is remakes. I think all of it is remakes.
It is now, yeah.
Yeah, which sort of demonstrates how compelling the actual story of the original is. So, like, I teach, for example, The Lion King in The Theory of Enchantment as a way to teach Stoicism. But I refuse to watch the new Lion King because I am so religiously attached to the original, and I saw the trailer for it and I was like, absolutely not. But I also think it has something to do with maybe suspending reality, right? Like reality is far more easily suspended when it's a cartoon as opposed to a live action. I think it starts to look a little weird when you see what actually looks like a real lion talking
right.
on screen.
Right. You know? Yeah. Especially in Cats. let's talk about Stoicism last. I love Stoicism, and I'm uneducated, so I never really knew what it was. But somebody did say to me, "Oh no, you're Stoic," and I was like, "I am. I don't know what that is exactly, but I may have some components of that, or I may live my life with some components of that." But that's something I'd like to get back to. In this mm-hmm. in this country, I feel like we could use it. Tell me what.
I think so too.
Tell me what you like about it, or your thoughts on it.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, Stoicism is an ancient Greek philosophy named after a stoa, which is Greek for a porch. So the idea is that these guys would sit around on porches contemplating life. But you know, some people who made it famous were Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus, and it's a philosophy that is essentially about being at one with the facts of life. So some of the teachings in Stoicism include, number one, meditate on your mortality, right? Be aware of the fact that you will die. And if you remember in The Lion King, this is one of the first things that Mufasa teaches his son. So understand that, make peace with that. Because when one does not make peace with that is the source of all kinds of different problems and all kinds of different conflicts, both internal and external. So meditate on your mortality. Remember that you will die is one of the primary teachings of Stoicism. And I don't think you can really have a healthy constitution internally if you don't really meditate on that. Another important teaching of Stoicism is to remember to take the view from above. So let's say, you know, you're driving in your car and someone cuts you off and you're like, this jackass just cut me off. What in the world? Remembering to take the view from above is supposed to remind you of the interconnectedness of life and to remind you that even though you're sort of in this moment, this is not the only thing that's happening. And so if you can imagine your position as if you were looking at it from space, you can sort of reorient your perspective, understand like what matters in literally the grand scheme of things and chill out. And also you can begin, this is sort of like a byproduct of Stoicism. You can begin to think to yourself, well, if this person just cut me off, are they rushing to the hospital? Is there an emergency in their life that's happening? So it also enables you to assume positive intent. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not, but if you assume positive intent, there's again, perspective becomes reality, and then it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I would say that those two things are two of the primary teachings. And to tie it to to Disney's The Lion King, the circle of life, right, which is the main song in The Lion King, is quite literally a song about those two principles. Like that's what is being sung, and that is what Simba has to learn in order to become king. He has to learn about the interconnectedness of life, right? He has to learn that, as Mufasa tells him, we're connected to the antelope and to the grass, and to everything you see is a delicate balance. And then Simba says, well, we eat the antelope. How is this possible, right? And then Mufasa says, yes, but let me explain. When we die, our bodies become the grass, and then the antelope eat the grass, right? So it's all a delicate balance. And Simba actually, in the beginning of the film, doesn't understand this. He's very juvenile. He's very selfish, actually, and he's very brazen. And so in order to awaken to his true purpose as the future king, he has to be confronted with those two things, the interconnectedness of life and the fact of his mortality, which is why he has to confront the fact that Mufasa dies. He has to be, and that is a part of his awakening process as a sort of being. So, you know, I could go into it a little bit more, but I think those two are some of the most important teachings. And if you want to read more on it, I would highly recommend looking into the works of Ryan Holiday, who's written a bunch of books on Stoicism. He's written a book called Everyday Stoicism. Mm-hmm. So it's like kind of like daily bread. Like you read a passage in Stoicism for all, you know, all day, 365 days of the year. And he also wrote another book called Stillness is the Key.
Yeah.
Which is his latest book.
He's been on He's also been on with Dr. Drew a few times as well. Has he been on this or I can't remember.
I think he has been on this, and I believe he is the one who told you are a Stoic.
Oh.
Oh, really?
I knew there was a reason I liked that dude. Chloe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's a really interesting conversation. Theoryofenchantment.com is where you go. If you want to check out her Twitter or Instagram, it's at CVALDARY. And business Twitter is at Enchant Theory. Did I miss anything, Chloe?
I would just also add, check out my latest article at USA Today. It's a cool piece about Dr. King and his approach to love and how we all need it to heal our nation right now.
So until next time, Adam Carolla for Chloe Valdery saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's back in stock. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.
Well, let me tell you about Geico. Geico's offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies. So you probably got one of those. Maybe you got all of those. That's 15% on top of the money Geico already saves you because they do such a great job. So what are you waiting for? Take care of business and take care of it with Geico. It's never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com.